If you're listening to this program, chances are you are a dog owner and a dog lover, and you want the best for your pet. We all do. It's natural. We want them to be healthy. We want them to have the best possible diets. So when you read something or hear about someone you know, heaven forbid, being affected by the tainted pet food a couple months ago, it's of great concern. And we start to naturally ask questions. Is what I'm feeding my dog the best possible food? Should I be cooking? Oh, no. Please don't make me cook my dog's food. And I decided it was time to focus on this with some experts. So I welcome to Good Dog Dr. Sean Delaney. He is a board-certified veterinary nutritionist, the vice president of the American College of Veterinary Nutrition, and as if that wasn't enough of a credential, associate veterinarian and assistant clinical professor at the UC Davis Veterinary School of Medicine. Welcome, Sean.
Well, thank you very much for the nice introduction.
Absolutely. So you decided somewhere along the line to focus, to narrow your focus from veterinary medicine down to veterinary nutrition. What about nutrition interested you?
Well, I have a colleague who likes to say, and I agree with it, that every animal eats. And so we're one of those nice specialties that gets to interact and to deal with every kind of patient, and not just patients, but just regular healthy pets. And so that's a nice aspect of what we do. You know, if you're an oncologist, you only see patients that have cancer. And so I like the breadth, if you will, of the field.
So narrowing our focus just for the purpose of this conversation to dogs, because I know you, I'm sure you focus on what all animals eat. Generally speaking, would you say that the pet food, the dog food industry is up to snuff? Is dog food generally good quality?
I think that it is, and I think you have to remember that although this was a very massive recall that occurred a couple of months ago, it still affected a very small percentage as a whole of just the foods that are available. Estimates are around 1%. Still way too much for anyone to accept, especially when it was an animal that you cared about that got ill. But as a general rule, it's a very, very high percentage, given also that this is a very unusual event, and it typically recalls involve, you know, a few or no foods at all in any given year. Given the number of animals, you know, 120 million animals, and roughly 90% plus of those animals are fed commercial food, that's a remarkable safety track record.
Yeah, one would think. Now, generally speaking, the way that our culture works, and certainly when the media gets a hold of a story and goes crazy, and we hear it on, you know, all the news networks and television magazines and everywhere else, are there cases where people's animals became ill and they are wrongly accusing the food or suspecting the food as being the cause of an illness?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, or when this first hit and, you know, people are asking those types of questions, one of the things went back and looked at is, you know, veterinary pet insurance has become more commonplace, and so some interesting data that it comes from, you know, claims for veterinary pet insurance, and one of those pieces of information was what are the top 10 reasons that, you know, a pet owner might visit their veterinarian, and for cats, in the top 10, and actually number 3, is for kidney or renal disease, and so that's a very common cause to go in, and so that's similar to, obviously, the signs and the things that happen with animals eating tainted food, and so you start to go, well, if that's normally a very common occurrence, you know, are people wrongly ascribing feeding a tainted food to the cause of the animal's disease that's already naturally occurring unrelated to, you know, a pet food issue?
We like to have something or someone to blame.
Well, I think that, you know, we certainly would prefer to identify something that we could control. I think that's certainly what is in our human nature, because if it's something that just happens, you know, unrelated to something that you can stop or change, that gives us a sense of powerlessness. And so I think that's really where it stems from. We would like to be able to control and say, oh, well, if I avoid these risk factors, my pet will live forever. Obviously, that's all of our goals, certainly not, you know, feasible.
Exactly. What do you feed your pets?
I happen to feed my own dog homemade pet food, and that's really because I have a specialty in making homemade diet formulations, and so I'm always curious about what people encounter when doing that. But I personally feel that commercial pet food is a good option and fed that for many, many years, and most of the people I work with feed commercial pet food.
And within the realm of commercial pet food, Dr. Delaney, should we spend the extra money for the high-end pet foods? Is it fine to buy what you see in the supermarket? Is, you know, can we buy in bulk at Costco, the Kirkland variety?
Sure. I mean, obviously, certain brands that were, you know, quote, you know, I guess, higher end as well as some foods that are kind of considered lower end were involved in the pet food recall, and that was certainly something that people looked at and said, well, you know, I thought when I purchased a more expensive brand, I was getting something different. And in fact, as a general rule, they were. And I think what's misleading is that the specific recall with menu foods that initiated some of this and where the majority of the recall was involved, it happened to be that they made a very unique type of food that a lot of manufacturers didn't either have the expertise or the equipment to make. But whenever a manufacturer makes food for another manufacturer, there's usually a lot of specifications within the contract why a food may be different. For example, you know, one brand may say, we only want you to use these particular ingredients, and we may want our protein and our fat level, which are more expensive ingredients in general, to be higher than maybe another food you're making for another manufacturer. So in fact, even though the equipment might have been the same, or even the manufacturing plant may have been the same, some of the ingredients or the specifications could have been very different, and thus the reason for a difference in cost, if you will.
Even looking, you know, away for just the moment of the notion of tainted pet food, just for general dog health, is there a big difference, do you think, between the lesser-priced commercially available pet foods and the more expensive ones?
Well, there are some potential differences. In general, when you go up kind of the price ladder, if you will, as you spend more money on food, one of the only common denominators, if you will, if you just are looking at a label, is that the fat content increases. And so as you look at quote-unquote premium foods, and there is no definition as to what that is, they usually are food that has more fat. And there's a variety of reasons why that would be, but if you can imagine, when you're a pet owner, when you're looking at performance indicators for any food you're feeding, you're really looking at some things that fat can affect positively. One of those would be obviously palatability, you know, how readily an animal eats, a higher fat content. It's, you know, we all know that high-fat foods are very tasty. That's true for dogs and cats as well. You also look for, you know, less backyard cleanup. And so if you add more fat to your food, you have a more energy dense or more calories per unit of volume. And so that translates into less, you know, feces. And so people like that higher digestibility, if you will, and not having to clean up the yard as much. And then finally, a higher fat tends to give a better sheen to the coat. I like to call that the, you know, teenage acne effect. You know, a high-fat meal just kind of greases up the coat, but that grease kind of spreads to the coat, and it gives it a nice sheen. And so when people are looking for, you know, indicators of the food's performing, they want to see their animal eating it well, they want their coat to look lustrous, and they really want, you know, not to have a lot of feces to clean up. And so by adding more fat in general, that makes the food achieve that, and that is a more expensive ingredient. So usually as you look at price, that's one of the common denominators. There's a variety of other things that may distinguish a lower-end food to a higher-end food. And when I'm referring to lower-end or higher-end, I'm really talking about price point more than anything else.
Interesting. So when one walks into a pet store and sees row upon row upon row of pet food, and now, and I don't know when exactly this happened, but I have to assume in the last 20 or so years, so many different choices within each brand. How do you know which direction to go in?
Well, there has been a lot of, you know, brand diversification, and that translates into a lot of different, you know, desires by ourselves, whether it be humanization, you know, we want to feed our pets like we feed ourselves, whether it be because we perceive certain ingredients as superior than others. You know, I like chicken better than I like beef, whatever that may be. That's a lot of the brand diversification you've seen. When you are looking for a food, when you're trying to decide, well, how do I select amongst this, there's a variety of things that I always suggest people use as kind of filtering devices. The first is probably a simple one, is it needs to be easy to get. And that seems kind of intuitive, but sometimes, you know, people go all ends of the earth, and, you know, you have to be able to find it at the store or be able to afford to get it to wherever you need to be feeding it to your animal. And so that's the first thing, you have to be able to get it. The second, I think, is always a good kind of discriminator, is try to pick brands you've heard of before. And, you know, granted, I don't want to penalize small regional pet food companies, but in general, when you go with very large companies, there's a track record or a history of performance, meaning that you have an expectation that, you know, if they've been around for 50 years, they probably make a good product. Two, larger brands can afford, you know, typically a little bit more research and development, so they may have, you know, nutritionists on staff. They may have actual ability to do research to help improve our knowledge on pet nutrition. They may give back to scientific research, and so I think that's good to point out and support. But probably more than any of those factors, larger brands have the ability to have more sentinels. And what I mean by that is if you feed a food that, you know, maybe you're the only one in your area that feeds, and you go into your veterinarian and there's some problem associated with the food, they may not recognize that it's with the food, and they think it's just unique to your pet because of some other illness. Whereas if you're feeding a very, very common brand food, and all of a sudden the veterinarians in your area are seeing, you know, animal after animal on that food having a similar problem, they're much more likely to identify and go, there's a connection here. We need to look into this further and identify that there may be a problem. So I think that sometimes having a food that's widely used is a good thing for that reason.
Very interesting. So not only for your own pet, but for really a pet public health issue, right?
Right. And I think that's a really important point. And then it comes down to other things. You know, some people will talk about selecting foods that have undergone AFCO feeding trials. That's where the food has actually been fed in a controlled environment to, you know, dogs or cats and of the particular life stage, you know, for maintenance or for, you know, gestation, lactation, growth, those kind of things, and look for any problems. Some foods just basically put foods together to meet a nutrient profile, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but there are times where maybe certain nutrients may interact with each other and decrease absorption. There may be some effect of, you know, foods that we can't predict, you know, using computer models, et cetera, and you have to actually feed it to the animal to make sure that the nutrients are available, meaning they actually can be absorbed. You might be able to measure them in the laboratory, but can the animal actually absorb those nutrients? And so some people prefer feeding trials because it does, you know, deal with that particular issue. There's other things that people can use to refine their search, and some of that becomes preference, you know, price, you know, what can you afford? That's obviously, I think, an important thing. What ingredients do you like to feed? You know, some people for dogs want to be, you know, feed them a vegetarian diet. So there are diets out there. And there may be people who have specific ingredients they prefer, as I mentioned earlier. All those things play a role in filtering. But the final and most important, I think, aspect of all this in selecting a food is how does the pet perform on it? Meaning, you know, I've had foods where I fed my own animal and for whatever reason they get a little bit of flatulence with it. Don't know why that was. Switch to a different food and it's gone away. And so, you know, there may be just things that in particular pets that particular foods work better. And, you know, you feed that food that caused my particular pet some flatulence and another animal might just do, you know, stellar. And so I think it's really important to remember that there is individualism and you have to look for that and go, you know, for my pet this food works just fine and maybe for yours it doesn't.
But do you caution people against switching pet foods too frequently?
Well, in general, you know, when you do a diet change, you're always concerned about causing a little bit of a GI upset. And some of that may be really a reflection of people not realizing that they're making rapid switches in maybe fiber or fat content or moisture content. So, you know, if all of a sudden you increase the fat content drastically, that could cause some GI distress. If all of a sudden you increase or decrease the fiber content from what you've been previously feeding, that could cause some GI distress. If all of a sudden, you know, you increase the moisture tremendously, that could cause some GI, you know, stress. And so generally people suggest that over 5 or 7 days you switch to the food. That gives the body a little bit more time to, you know, kind of acclimate to the new food. But in general, there's nothing wrong with doing switches of food. It's just that, you know, people try to avoid doing, you know, everyday type of switches because of the GI distress. You know, and there's nothing wrong with feeding a food for long periods of time, months on end, if the animal's doing well in it. You have to remember that unlike human foods, commercial pet foods that are complete and balanced, and they'll actually say that on their label, have all the nutrients that an animal would need for lifelong feeding. And so it's perfectly appropriate to feed the same food day in and day out, because if you ever look at those ingredient lists, the first few ingredients, you know, obviously look very familiar to you, but then there's this long laundry list of vitamins and minerals that have been added to make sure that it has all the needed nutrients in it.
Pet foods are regulated by the FDA in the United States, aren't they?
They are, and, you know, the FDA has obviously been under a lot of scrutiny with the recall, and, you know, I think people's belief of what does that really mean may have been a little bit, believe that the FDA had a little bit more control than they really do. What I mean by that is the FDA has really historically been very focused on drug claims on pet food. For example, you know, if all of a sudden you put a pet food out there that says treats X disease, they're going to be very aggressively, you know, pulling your food off of the shelf. They're obviously involved when, you know, major concerns come with a, you know, tainted ingredient like we saw recently, and we all saw the FDA's role in that. But a lot of the regulation also falls under individual states. State regulatory officials at the state level have a lot of power and a lot of control of foods that come in and out of their state. They come together and make model regulations. That's that AFCO I referred to, the AAFCO. And those are typically those guidelines which involve not just pet foods but also livestock feed and what you can call certain ingredients, et cetera. Those really get adopted by each individual state and become, in essence, the law of the land, even though those are not the AFCO regulations, if you will, are not any legal, have no legal standing. They become by default kind of the national standard, because if you're going to sell food to any state, you're going to need to follow those to kind of give yourself protection over one state saying, well, no, you're not following our rules. We have unique rules, et cetera. They try to make them more model national rules.
So in general, your message, not to put words in your mouth, but to pet owners would be trust the big companies, trust the commercial pet food manufacturers that have good reputations and that have been around for a long time?
I think that's a general rule. You know, I think there's nothing wrong against smaller companies that are coming up and may have things that your animal enjoys or you personally prefer. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I think that you always want to find foods that, you know, are seem reputable, that have been around for a while, that don't make claims that seem too good to be true. I think that's always a warning sign. And I think you have to recognize that, you know, even in the human food chain, we run into problems. You know, we have had our own food recalls, and there is always an inherent risk with, you know, industrialization and globalization of our food chain.
Great. Thanks so much for your comments today, Dr. Delaney.
My pleasure. You have a great rest of the day.
That wraps up another episode of Good Dog. Thanks for your emails. Next week's episode on pit bulls and breed-specific legislation, or BSL for short, resulted from a note from a Good Dog listener. If you like what you're hearing, please tell your friends. Write a review on the iTunes store or send an email to gooddog@smarterpodcasts.com.